previous programs, and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Despite Afghanistan being described by the UN as the world's largest and most severe humanitarian crisis, the World Food Programme has announced it's cutting down aid to 4 million people in the country. Considering the current economic situation in Afghanistan, experts have expressed concerns over the impact of humanitarian aid being reduced.
Considering that half of the population is in poverty and face hunger, cutting or reducing humanitarian aid can cause serious problems. In the short term, it exacerbates hunger, and in the long term, it leads to food crisis.
Women and children starve to death because of politics, and so we're there
for them. The WFP has warned that the aid shortfall could push Afghans into famine. 8 to 4 million people has been cut. At least the nation is now one step closer to famine. This is while there are still millions of people in Afghanistan who haven't received any humanitarian aid at all.
I guarantee that I have never received any aid from any international organization. This is why we are really poor. Why should I work with a wheelbarrow under the scorching sun? It is because I am poor.
This April, the WFP cut off assistance to 4 million aid recipients in the country, decreasing the number from 13 million to 9 million. They have stated that this reduction is due to severe funding constraints. People here are wondering why international donors show less attention to Afghanistan at this critical period. Considering the fact that Afghanistan is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, experts say if this trend of international aid being cut down continues, people might face famine in the near future. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Afghanistan has joined the chorus of condemnation against Israel for its brutal attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Gaza City. The Afghan acting foreign ministry, led by the Taliban, has issued a statement denouncing the Israeli occupation forces for violating the sanctity of Islam's third holy site and harming innocent Muslims. The statement said that Afghanistan stands in solidarity with the Palestinian people and supports their legitimate rights to freedom from occupation.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan condemns in the strongest possible terms the brutal attack by Israeli forces on defenseless worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Such inhumane acts are a flagrant violation of international, Islamic and humanitarian law, a provocation of Muslims around the world, and an insult against values and sanctities.
The Afghan people also expressed their outrage against Israeli atrocities and voiced their support for the Palestinians through gatherings and social media campaigns. Afghan human rights activists and citizens condemned the Israeli regime for its crimes against humanity and its desecration of the holy places of Islam. They have also urged the Muslim world to unite and defend the cause of Palestine.
As everyone knows, Al-Aqsa Mosque is the first Qibla of Muslims. It is of key importance for us historically and culturally. Palestine is a state of Muslims, and there is no such thing as Israel. Western arrogance has occupied Palestinians' land to use it as a bastion against Muslims. Western countries, which is silent in the face of Israeli atrocities, are committing crimes against humanity and Muslim Ummah.
Al-Quds is Muslims' strength and an axis to gather around. All Muslims should be vigilant about the developments in the holy city. We Afghans are firmly standing beside our Palestinian brothers and support them.
Afghan people have a long history of resisting foreign occupation and aggression. They can relate to the plight of the Palestinians and their struggle for freedom and dignity. Afghan people will continue to stand by their Palestinian brothers and sisters until they achieve their rights and justice. People here are also gearing up for the International Quds Day rallies, as Afghans remain steadfast in their support for Palestinians. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's first attempts to acquire peaceful nuclear technology date back to the late 1950s, when Tehran Research Reactor was built and the program accelerated a decade later with the construction of the Bushehr nuclear power plant. The result of a proposed agreement for cooperation in research and peaceful uses of atomic energy by the U.S., which ironically today opposes the program. Ever since, Iran has maintained the same position, acquiring nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and development of the country. However, the road has been bumpy for Iran, and the country has had a hard time establishing the fact that as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it is entitled to do so. Despite U.S. sanctions and Western pressure, in 2006, Iran announced that it had successfully domesticated the complete cycle of uranium enrichment. This great step forward is marked in the Iranian calendar as National Nuclear Technology Day. This know-how opened new horizons, particularly paving the way for producing heavy water. And this led to Iran producing amino acids labeled with deuterium, used for early diagnosis of metabolic diseases, and also producing deuterium gas to make semiconductors and optical fibers. Iran's achievements in acquiring nuclear technology for peaceful purposes also resulted in producing radioisotopes used in nuclear medicine. And today, Iran is among a handful of countries that produces iridium-192. Iran has had countless achievements applying nuclear technology in fields such as medicine, agriculture, and electronics. And today, Iranian scientists have gained a foothold in this industry. This prompted head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, to propose to upscale an annual national conference on the peaceful uses of nuclear energy to an international one with the assistance of the IAEA, a proposal well received by the Director General.
We discussed with the Vice President and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran about an important event which is going to be taking place next year in Iran, where the traditional annual nuclear science conference that is held every year in Iran is going to have an international character. And we are discussing how to provide support from the IAEA, make it a bigger international event to foster links on the peaceful uses of nuclear energy.
This means that Iran could turn into a regional hub sharing its know-how regarding peaceful applications of nuclear technology. But these achievements did not come without a price. Iranian nuclear scientists have often been the target of an assassination campaign led by Israel. However, this has not stopped Iran from moving forward.
National Nuclear Energy Day usually falls on April the 9th. For Iranians, it is an occasion to reflect on the very long way they've come since 2006 in acquiring peaceful nuclear technology. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
In a bid to ditch the U.S. dollar and evade illegal U.S. sanctions, New Delhi is taking drastic measures to boost its own currency for international trade. Experts say Western sanctions on Russia prompted rupee-ruble trade transactions as an alternative to the U.S. dollar. They say other countries should follow suit. The South Asian nation aims to achieve the goal of $2 trillion of exports by 2030, as the new India trade policy will help settle trade disputes faster without any roadblock.
India has already started doing the international trade through the use of rupee. Now, this will help in many ways. The first is, it will increase the spectrum of exports to various countries. Secondly, all those countries which are suffering from sanctions, partially or fully, will have an option to deal with India. And finally, the export basket of India will increase phenomenally.
India is among several countries exploring means of trading with other countries in an effort to bypass the dollar, which has been dominating the international trading market for decades. In recent weeks, New Delhi has signed a pact with Malaysia, allowing trade in local currency. Economists say this will help promote trade between the South Asian nations, as Ukraine war has put pressure on their foreign exchanges due to rising oil and food prices.
India's primary imports are of the crude. Now, once the Indian currency is used as international trade or on bilateral with those countries where we import, we will have an option to pay in rupees rather than dollars. Now, thereby, we will have a better price discovery and the cost of the imports will reduce substantially.
Like many developing countries, India is also holding key discussions with its financial partners on trading in rupee, including key oil suppliers such as Iran, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. India has already established a rupee-ruble payment mechanism with Moscow. Since July last year, 18 countries have set up a rupee account with Indian banks. They are now making efforts to circumvent the dollar for trade. China and Russia have already taken major steps to avoid impacts of U.S. sanctions. They're also exploring options how to promote the use of their currencies.
The decision by growing number of countries to trade in local currency is aimed at reducing reliance on U.S. dollar as a dominant currency for international trading. Experts say such move will encourage closer economic cooperation between the nations. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
A new quarterly report by ENEA, the National Agency for New Technologies, Energy and Sustainable Economic Development, has found that electricity and gas prices skyrocketed in Italy last year. According to the research agency, the average price of electricity rose by 100%, while the price of gas increased by nearly 60% over the previous year. Most analysts have been blaming this rise solely on the war in Ukraine. However, some energy market experts and an increasing number of people from the general public have come to different conclusions over the past months.
The spike in energy prices started before the war in Ukraine. It was driven by reduced gas imports from Russia, which later aggravated. EU member countries were then being forced to get their energy supplies from other sources at much higher costs.
It was just big-time speculation on energy markets. The emergency, the war in Ukraine, they were just pretexts. I think most people have realized that.
The Enea report on soaring energy prices also points out that high prices are not only badly impacting households, but remain a serious threat to the competitiveness of the Italian and European industry. When the government was formed last October, Prime Minister Meloni vowed that her administration would combat speculation and unjustified increases in the cost of energy. 6 months later, the Italians are still struggling with high energy prices and the consequent soaring cost of living.
So far, the Meloni government has put forward roughly the same measures adopted by the previous executive to counter rising energy costs. The government's latest initiative, which I'm afraid will bring little results, features obliging petrol stations to display the average national price of fuel alongside the prices that they charge to avoid speculation. It should not be forgotten that Meloni has also scrapped a 400 million euro windfall tax on energy giants.
The cost of energy has tripled. Last month, our bill was 181 euros for a three-member family in a two-story flat. Are they crazy?
In Italy, gas accounts for more than half of residential energy consumption. Rome covers more than two-thirds of its energy needs by imports. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranians have held an iftar ceremony from the 14th to the 19th of the holy month of Ramadan in Palestine Square in Tehran. This iftar banquet features different cultural programs and is aimed at highlighting the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause.
A real Muslim is the one who fights the oppressor and defends the oppressed. Today, Zionism is the great evil and we are determined to defeat Israel. This event is held to show support for the resistance in Palestine.
The issue of Palestine is a big and important topic that all people, whether young or old, from all over the world should know about it. We try to introduce children to this topic from an early age so that they understand the importance of the freedom they have here while Palestinian children are deprived of it.
Participants in this event sympathized with Palestinians in the occupied territories who have been facing a new round of aggression during the holy month of Ramadan and voiced their support for the oppressed people in Palestine.
Unfortunately, at a time when Palestinian children, youth and families should be having iftar during the holy month of Ramadan, they're facing aggression and bombs. As supporters of the oppressed people of Palestine, we promise to continue our efforts.
My family and I have come to Palestine Square in Tehran to show our support for the oppressed people of Palestine who are fighting for their rights and their land under a lot of pressure these days.
This event also features Palestinian dishes as well as performances of anthems and other cultural programs.
While Ramadan is celebrated by millions of Muslims around the world, Palestinians are facing a new round of Israeli aggression during this holy month. Ramadan is the month of helping the oppressed, and this event is aimed at expressing the sympathy of Iranians to the oppressed people of Palestine. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
I read you. A motto to promote not just reciting the Holy Quran regularly, but also reading and understanding its verses with the aim of using its detailed guidance and implementing its teachings in every aspect of our lives. This is the motto of the 30th Tehran International Quran Exhibition that is currently underway in the Iranian capital and will be running until April 15th. Paintings depicting verses and teachings of the Holy Quran, as well as calligraphy and illumination artworks, are on display at this annual exhibition, which is held every year in Tehran during the holy month of Ramadan. Artists from 21 countries are here to present their works and hold workshops. Some rare manuscripts and books related to the Holy Quran, including interpretations of the Holy Book, are also showcased. Publishers from several countries have brought their newly printed copies of the Holy Quran as well.
Most of our works are related to lessons from the Holy Quran by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. This year, we managed to publish his simplified version of the translation of the Holy Quran, an easy-to-read and understand copy, which is an excellent choice for anyone who wants to understand the Holy Quran.
Tehran's International Quran Exhibition is the most significant exhibition of its kind in the Muslim world. World-renowned Quran reciters usually participate, and recently it has also gained a reputation for offering the latest version of Quran AI apps and electronic devices, including Quran reading pens.
We have very special customers, and our products appeal to a wide range of people. We usually receive a lot of orders from Muslim countries, including Persian Gulf littoral states. Our main product is this electronic reading pen that can recite verses of the Holy Quran. It comes with a memory stick and can hear recitations from more than a dozen of the world's best reciters.
As always, the exhibition will be hosting several Quranic competitions. Researchers and university professors have also been invited to talk about the Holy Quran and its teachings.
This is the 30th year that the Islamic Republic is hosting this annual Quran exhibition or conference. There are many things going on as we speak. As you probably have reported, we have families in Tehran and from some other cities coming and visiting. We have people that produce software, Quranic software. We have people who produce books on Quran. We have children books, different activities that are presented annually here.
A series of international webinars have also been scheduled to discuss the latest studies on the Holy Quran and related topics, accessible to all of those who cannot attend.
The 30th International Quran Exhibition opened on April the 1st with the aim of promoting the Holy Quran and Quranic teachings. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
in the limelight.
The Confederation of National Health Service of England has warned about the consequences of crippling strike by junior doctors and the cancellation of tens of thousands of medical appointments in the midst of the country's healthcare crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The National Health Service Confederation has said up to a quarter of a million medical appointments and operations could be postponed because of 4 days of strikes in the coming days by junior doctors in England. Dr. Leila McKay, the Director of Policy at the Confederation, which represents Health Trust, said National Health Service bosses were more concerned about the impact of the later strike than any other that had taken place so far. Junior medics in England will take industrial action after the Easter bank holiday weekend from 6:59 a.m. on Tuesday 11th of April until 6:59 a.m. local time on Saturday 15th of April. The British Medical Association, BMA, the UK's trade union for doctors and medical students, said the strikes could still be avoided if the government made a credible pay offer. Dr. Leila McKay told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "In the last junior doctor strike, we saw about 175,000 appointments and operations having to be postponed. In terms of the disruption that we're anticipating this time, we reckon it could be up to about a quarter of a million. So that is a huge amount of impact for patients up and down the country." She added, "What we're hearing from our members who are health leaders across the whole system is that they're more concerned about this than they have been about any other strike. They think that the impact is going to be significant, that this one is likely to have impact on patient safety, and that is a huge concern for every healthcare leader." Dr. Mike Greenall, a deputy chair of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, told BBC One's Breakfast, "It's hard to negotiate when only one side is doing it, and we're not getting anything back from the government." Dr. Mike Greenall added, "We're happy to meet at any time. We would still meet him over the bank holiday weekend before the industrial action next week, and if he was to bring a credible offer to us, it could still, even at this late stage, avert action." The Department of Health and Social Care has insisted the British Medical Association has to call off the strike for any negotiations to take place. The British Medical Association has called on Steve Barclay to negotiate to resolve what it calls 15 years of pay erosion, with junior doctors losing more than 26% of their pay in real terms. Dr. Mike Greenhall said, "At the moment, we have over 7 million people on waiting lists, and the way we can get that down is making sure the National Health Service is properly funded and properly staffed." Sky News has also covered this story and tells us more. Stephen Powis, National Medical Director for NHS England, said in a statement, "We're very concerned about the potential severity of impact on patients and services across the country," highlighting that hospitals face almost 100 hours without as little as half of the NHS medical workforce. The strike comes at a particularly busy time for the National Health Service, with demand for services expected to be high after the Easter bank holiday weekend, and many other NHS staff on annual leave during the school holidays. Dr. Leila McKay said the disruption could last up to 10 or 11 days, with a strike running between the Easter bank holiday and another weekend. She said the impact is going to be so significant that this one is likely to have impact on patient safety, and that is a huge concern for every healthcare leader. Hospital bosses have said they cannot guarantee patients will be safe as managers struggle to arrange staffing during the strike, which will affect both emergency and planned care. The British Medical Association, BMA, has also announced that it will not exempt any services, but that there are plans to protect patients, which could involve pulling junior doctors off the picket line if individual hospitals report lives are in immediate danger. Dr. Mike Greenhall, a deputy chair of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, has apologised to patients who had their operations or appointments cancelled, and he insisted patient safety would not be put at risk. Dr. Mike Greenhall claimed patient safety was maintained at the last strikes, and it will be also in this strike. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay had been urged to meet union representatives in an attempt to resolve the issue, but the negotiations remained deadlocked last night since the minister insisted the British Medical Association has to call off the strike for any negotiations to take place. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay wrote in The Telegraph, "It is deeply disappointing that this industrial action has been timed by the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee to cause maximum disruption to both patients and other NHS staff. The junior doctors insist it is up to the health secretary to make them a credible offer." Dr. Vivek Trivedi and Dr. Rob Lawrenson, the co-chairs of the British Medical Association Junior Doctors Committee, said the strikes could still be avoided if the government made a credible pay offer. Junior doctors are asking for a 35% pay rise to reverse the steep decline they have faced after years of below-inflation pay rises. The British Medical Association says that since 2008-2009, they have had a real-term pay cut of 26%, and they are now seeking full pay restoration. They also want to agree on a mechanism to prevent future declines in their pay and to reform the pay review process. The strike would be the latest in a wave of disruptive labour actions by public sector workers in the United Kingdom demanding pay hikes to offset inflation that exceeds 10%. Passport office staff were on strike last week. Civil servants plan to strike on 28th of April, and the UK's biggest teaching union, the National Education Union, is preparing for 5 more days of walkouts. A cost-of-living crisis driven by sharp food and energy price increases has left the British people struggling to pay their bills, as union wages have fallen in real terms over the past decade. Almost a quarter of British adults are in a worse financial position in 2023 during the cost-of-living crisis, while the number of those struggling to pay back their loans has increased by half since last year. This is according to the second annual financial inclusion report, now published by ethical lender Plend. The FinTech Times said the report focuses on the impact of the cost of living crisis, personal and household finances, and the resultant impacts on access to financial services in the United Kingdom. The findings emphasize how badly some groups, including young people and ethnic minorities, have been affected more by the cost of living crisis than by the coronavirus pandemic.
Minutes. With mounting food, energy, and housing costs, UK household budgets are becoming increasingly stretched. And as the cost of living crisis worsens, vulnerable families and their children are being pushed to the edge.
People are struggling to eat. People are struggling to heat their homes as well. That has a knock-on effect in terms of general health and well-being. So we get more people that turn up at accidents in emergency, more people that might be using drugs and alcohol to alleviate the symptoms caused by the poverty that they're feeling.
Around 13.4 million people were living in poverty in the UK between 2020 and 2021, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Analysis from the foundation has revealed 3.9 million children were living in poverty in the UK in the same period of time.
We regularly have people who come in that may not have eaten for 2-3 days. We didn't used to see that before. I also had a family where one night they fed the son, the next night they fed the daughter because they can't feed everyone. I just think it's shameful that we're in a relatively wealthy city that we have people that are struggling so, so much.
Child poverty increased most dramatically in the northeast of England between 2015 and 2020, rising by over a third, from 26% to 37% of all children. Demand for free school meals is also highest in the northeast, where around 29.1% of children currently qualify, compared to just 17.6% in the southeast.
We all know inflation's going up, you know, by a lot, but it's people that are on the lowest incomes that will suffer the most, because the products that they're buying, so basic food, isn't just going up by 10% or whatever, it's going up by 100%.
But while the Northeast now has the highest rate of child poverty across the regions, many of the worst affected constituencies and local authorities continue to be in London, according to Action for Children. This is due to high housing costs in the capital. The Childhood Trust has found 40% of children aged 6 to 16 are facing food poverty in London, meaning their families cannot afford to keep them fed.
In a city like London, one of the most thriving cities in the world, it's shocking. It's shocking to think that that number of children and our families are struggling to make ends meet and are struggling to provide the food that they need for their families. It's really quite a shocking statistic, I think.
In the words of Lawrence Guinness, Childhood Trust Chief Executive, we've never seen levels of food insecurity at that high before. It's an alarm bell in the face of growing adversity and the diminishing power of household income. Tower Hamlets is the borough with the highest rate of child poverty after housing costs, with a rate of 51%. Child poverty rates are also high in other large cities like Birmingham and Manchester. The latest data available shows children from black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to be in poverty at 46% compared to 26% of children in white British families. Children's charities, schools, and food aid organizations are working tirelessly to plug the gaps created by the welfare system. Food banks are now being set up in schools so children have enough to eat.
Research by the Child Poverty Action Group earlier this year estimated that 1 in 3 school children living in poverty don't qualify for a free school meal. So when we talk about hunger, we're talking about children coming to school and relying on a hot, nutritious meal at lunchtime. And the figures around the 1 in 3 are sitting at around 800,000 children. And that's why we're running a campaign to extend eligibility so more families living in poverty can access good nutrition at lunchtime.
Living in poverty can have a serious impact on a child's well-being. Some report feeling ashamed and unhappy and worry about their parents. Disadvantaged children are more likely to develop severe mental health problems by age 11 than their well-off peers. Kids in inadequate housing have been shown to be more at risk of respiratory illnesses and meningitis. Those in the most disadvantaged areas can expect 20 fewer years of good health in their lives than children in places with more resources.
So when you're living in a cold, damp home, that causes huge problems. If you're in, if you've got pre-existing heart conditions, if you've got respiratory illnesses such as long COVID or COVID itself, if you've got asthma or COPD or other lung conditions, all of those things are made much, much worse by living in a cold, damp home. If you're recovering from surgery, that can take longer for your wounds to heal because you're living in a cold, damp home. So there's a whole range of different things that are affected by the problem of fuel poverty. And that's why if we don't solve these things through economic measures, we're going to see a long-term health crisis affecting our country.
On the rise alongside poverty is childhood obesity, with rates at an all-time high. Children aged 4 to 5 in the most deprived 10% of the population are 75% more likely to be overweight or obese than those in the most affluent 10%. Poverty even puts kids at greater risk of being groomed or exploited by criminal gangs. There are reports that children whose families are mired in deep poverty are stealing basic items such as food and tissues from their schools, and some are missing lessons altogether because they cannot afford the bus fare. In November last year, The Independent published a horrible report about schoolchildren and parents shoplifting to feed themselves and their families. Meanwhile, the Children's Society is warning that government support does not go far enough, as thousands of children are at risk of malnutrition this winter. Campaigners and economic experts have repeatedly called for an overhaul of the Social Security safety net, particularly reforms for universal credit and an end to the two-child limit to receiving some benefits. The 20-pound cut to universal credit in October 2021 plunged families back into poverty after giving them light relief throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Surprisingly enough, successive conservative chancellors have reduced tax credits and benefits for low-income families with children while introducing tax cuts that have benefited the better off.
We are calling the government to increase its support in order to get through this winter. And we are also calling the government to think about enduring solutions, especially in the area of energy efficiency, in order to reduce very significantly the level of consumption of our customers.
According to The Observer, the UK has become a hostile place to have children, as parents are being forced to bring their offspring in conditions that will have grave repercussions for society. It starts even before birth. It's estimated that more than 1,000 babies die or are left with severe injuries each year as a result of something going wrong during labor. Meanwhile, the number of child abduction offenses has been on the rise. Over the past decade, nearly 10,000 children have been abducted. In one case in late January, dozens of asylum-seeking children were kidnapped by gangs from a Brighton hotel run by the Home Office in a pattern apparently being repeated across the South Coast. It has emerged that the Home Office was warned repeatedly by police that the vulnerable occupants of the hotel, asylum-seeking children, who had recently arrived in the UK without parents or carers, would be targeted by criminal networks. Child poverty in the UK is reaching worrying levels. Paltry wages, low benefit payments, and a cost of living crisis mean the UK's poorest families and their children are getting poorer. But will the UK government do something meaningful in this regard? History is not promising, but we'll have to wait and see.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen and Brother Mustafa. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Mohsen. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Mustafa, assalamu
alaikum. Assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Muhammad Baqir Behbahani, mainly known as Wahid al-Behbahani. His main struggles were against the Akhbaris on that time and his time. We'll talk more about this aspect of the life of Wahid Behbahani. But before that, let's get to his early life and his scholarly life. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Muhammad Baqir Behbahani was known as Wahid Behbahani or Wahid Asr. Or he was also known as the Greater Teacher or the Ustad Kul.
Yes.
Kul means like the one who knows everything. Mm-hmm. And the second Allama or Muhakkik Thalith, because
yes,
we had the Muhakkik before it. So he was the third Muhakkik. He was one of the Usuli Ulama and was against the Akhbarism, we can say. And what we see is that he was born in Isfahan, since he was Behbahani. And after that, he was one of the students of Allama Majlisi. And from his children, we can say like he had children like Muhammad Ali, who was one of the great and famous scholars in Kirmanshah. And the other son of him, Abdul Hussein, was the responsible for the financial
yes
issues of his father when he was a marja.
Yes.
Obviously, in the office of marja, there are different things that are obviously needs to be dealt with, especially the financial terms when the khums and zakat comes, and so on. He basically have studied his initial studies in Isfahan. And he has got the initial things, like initial, we can say, like his schooling was by his father, where he studied by his father. And after that, he went to the Najaf, where he had the teachers like Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai Burujardi.
Yes.
And the other ulama. About his students, what we can say is that he was a great scholar, that amongst his students we can take the name of Mullah Mahdi al-Naraqi.
Yes.
Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Tabatabai, who was known as Baharul Ulum. We had the Abu Ali Hayri, who wrote the Muntaha al-Maqal.
Yes.
Mullah Ahmad al-Naraqi also was known as his students. Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Isfahani, Mirza Abul Qasim Qummi, Kashiful Ghita.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the great names, basically.
Yes.
Who were in the Hawza of Najaf and Karbala. So these were the main, we can say, like students of Wahid Behbahani. On the other hand, we can see like he wrote the books on the fiqh. Obviously, he
yes
was a jurist. And there are 119, we can say, like the books and the articles which he wrote. And they were on different issues. And his main popularity was due to his combat with the Akhbaris.
We got to that. Let's get to Brother Mustafa and have more. We can say Wahid al-Behbahani from his tongue. Okay, Brother Mustafa, give us more information about the scholarly life of Wahid al-Behbahani, especially as Sayyid said, his approach and where does this conflict come from? I mean, Akhbaris and Usulis, disagreement in the houses, and what was the role of Wahid al-Behbahani in order to recreate a kind of new atmosphere in the houses for Akhbaris?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Behbahani spent most of his scholarly life in Behbahan, and in the house of Behbahan, there were many scholars coming from Bahrain.
Mm-hmm.
And those who were coming from Bahrain, mainly they were Akhbaris.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhakkik Behbahani was against Akhbarism. So he spent most of his time that he lived in Behbahan trying to fight or trying to deal with this issue of Akhbarism. And he wrote one of his famous books, Al-Ijtihad wal-Akhbar. It was a kind of defense for Ijtihad, and he wrote it in Behbahan. So, and also when he went after a while, when he traveled and settled in Karbala, Karbala was also a center for Akhbarism, yes. Especially when Sheikh Yusuf Bahrani was the great teacher and the great Shia scholar who was living there. So even there, he tried his best to clarify and somehow explain to the people and the scholars that right. Akhbarism is not the correct way of thinking and thoughts.
So the type of Ijtihadi look in the Islamic houses was over there, isn't it? So now the Akhbaris are going to negate the whole Ijtihad. Is it so? Is it done by the Akhbaris? I mean, they negate the whole, we can say, the concept of Ijtihad?
They believed, I mean, as it was explained earlier, that we have the sources of our takalif and our obligations is either Quran or either Hadith. So, but there is no reasoning, there is no istidlal and ijtihad when we are dealing with our takalif and our obligations. So if there is something written in the narrations, in a hadith and in akhbar, so we accept it. If it is not there, so there is no other way to come to a conclusion regarding an issue in religious affairs.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La
ilaha illallah. So in this way, for the Akhbaris, there is no place for intellect, for aql or istidlal, is it so?
Well, obviously we cannot say like there is no place. They do use the intellect when when they bring a hadith and they start to argue, or the arguments on the hadith, how this hadith proves a specific rule. They're actually doing that. But obviously they take it under the narrations. They say we need to have a narration first to prove something, and then they do the discussion.
Okay.
Whereas the usulis, they say in the place where we do not have any narration and the hadith and the verse of the Quran, what should we do? And there is the place of ijtihad. Ijtihad means the scholar struggles. He tries to understand through other ahadith, through the, you know, the intellectual ways that we have seen, for example, how the ulama used to do. There is the ijma of the ulama as well. It is also involved. And there are many other principles.
When we face a hadith, so there are some wordings over there by the infallibles. There is a hadith. So according to the akhbaris, are we allowed to discuss about the hadith and do and use our intellect in order to have our own understanding? Is it so? Or no?
We're not doing our own understanding of the hadith. That does not mean. The mean is that what hadith has said, they need to explain in the same way. For example, hadith is talking about a specific thing. So they just talk about that specific thing and they do not go beyond that.
Okay.
Whereas the ijtihad is that where hadith is saying this, maybe it's proving something else as well.
Okay.
So they do ijtihad. Or maybe like, you know, the hadith is quite about a specific issue. So there you need to do the ijtihad. We cannot leave as a mujtahid. It is the duty of the mujtahid to not leave the muqallid, the one who's following, in a situation where he is confused. He has to take the people out of confusion.
Yes.
If he cannot take them out of the confusion through the ijtihad, then he says, for example, this is ihtiyat. For example, this is you need to refer maybe to another mujtahid or a'lam, the one who knows better than this, because I could not reach to a specific, you know, decision. On the other hand, when we look at the personality of the, you know, the scholarly personality,
or the social personality of Behbahani, Wahid yes. Behbahani, it is enough to say that Allama Bahrul Ulum and Sahibul Riyadh,
yes,
they both have called him Allama.
Yes.
And Allama means a highly, you know...
a polymath is polymath. What they say, yes.
Yes. Yes. On the other hand, Sahibul Jawahir and Sheikh Ansari, they have called him Ustadi Akbar or Ustadi Kul,
yes,
the greater teacher. So, you know, with these personalities that we have mentioned, when they have remembered him in such a way, it means that he was a great scholar. He was, you know, the man of what he used to, you know, teach. And also on top of that, he had the akhlaqi characteristics, you know, his akhlaqi characteristics or akhlaqi, we can say, point of view. He was of the best character.
That's right.
So that such people who were the writers of, you know, the books of ethics, they were also calling him as a teacher.
Okay. And the story between Wahid Behbahani and Sheikh Yusuf Behrani is really interesting, because when he entered Karbala at that time, as you said, the Akhbaris were over there. And for 3 days, we can say
he requested.
Yeah, he requested to Behrani. Teach instead of Behrani. And since Behrani was a moderate man, he led Behbahani to do the teaching. And after 3 days, we could see that 2/3 of the students of the Akhbaris, we can say, changed their approach into the Usuli one. Since that time onward, we can see the house of Karbala was under the shadow of Wahid Behbahani and his teachings. Okay, brother Mustafa, can you name some of his works for us? I mean, beside the other works.
Of course, Maghrib Behbahani was also a prolific author. He yes. has many books in different fields of study, especially in fiqh and usul. In Usul, he has a great book, Al-Rasail Al-Usuliyah, which discusses basically the reasons, or it brings proofs for ijtihad and istidlal. This book contains 8 treatises in Arabic, especially the first one, which is the main and the most important one, is Ar-Risalat al-Ijtihad wal-Akhbar. So
that's
in
right.
this treatise, he goes deeply and he goes profoundly regarding the issue of Ijtihad and Akhbar. And in some points, he proves that Akhbarism and Akhbari school of thought is not enough and is not the perfect and the true way of thinking.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Mustafa and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, for a nice elaboration on the life of Wahid Behbahani. Yes, Wahid Behbahani passed away on Shawwal 29th, 1205, according to the Hijri lunar calendar. At the end of his life, which was a long life, 83 life, he only, we can say, taught Sharh al-Lum'ah, and ordered his outstanding student, Bahrul Ulum, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, to get back to the city of Najaf and take care of the houses over there. And after he passed away, his body was taken into the city of Karbala, and he was buried in the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam by the foot of the martyrs of Karbala. May Allah bless the soul of Wahid Behbahani, the reviver of the Usuli school of thought of the houses, of the Elmias, of the Shiite world. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen and Brother Mustafa, for a nice elaboration. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.